The Lower University was one of the oldest complexes in Londres Nova. The first marks had been made by automated construction mechs when there had been only a few thousand people on the planet. The halls were simple, direct, rectilinear, and hard. In the commons area, what everyone referred to as outside, there had been some attempt to soften and humanize the space, but within, it was low ceilings and right angles. It didn't help that the original colonial designs hadn't recessed any of the infrastructure. Halls that were narrow already had water pipes and electrical cables crowding in at the corners. The flooring was all metal grate, and David had to duck to get through the doorways. The suction from hundreds of fume hoods venting out to the atmosphere reclamation plants kept a constant breeze blowing against the main doors, pushing the students in and then keeping them from getting out. David's locker was in the third hall corridor. Seniors' row. It was twice as wide as the one he'd had just the year before, and the locking mechanism didn't stick the way the old one had. He'd put a couple decals on the outer face, a picture of Kaz Pratihari, a kanji print cartoon, but nothing like the multicolored glow of the one next to him. It belonged to an industrial engineering girl, who he never saw unless they were in the hall at the same time. All the lockers had something, though, a picture, a whiteboard, some in-joke one-liner printed on plastic and fused to the metal, some little mark to say that this space belongs to someone in particular. Someone a little, but only a little, different from the others. At the end of the cycle, everyone in the seniors' row would get their placements, empty the lockers, and go to wherever they were put next. The lockers would be scrubbed clean, decontaminated, sealed, and made anonymous again for whichever student was assigned it next. David had heard about sandcastles on beaches being washed away by the tide, but he'd never seen an ocean. The lockers of Seniors' Row were the closest analog among things he actually knew. David closed the door and turned down toward his workstation. With the tube stations running, his parents back at the house, and the Lower University open, the lab was the place he disliked least. The long muscles in his back and legs still ached a little after his night sampling his own wares, and he was half relieved that he could tell Lily he'd tried it, and half relieved that his schedule wouldn't let him try it again. The whole thing had been like having a very long, pleasant, but kind of boring dream, and it had left his head feeling a little hazy in a way he didn't enjoy. His lab work was almost at its final phase. The terminal built into his desk was arranged to display the data on all seven studies that were making up the complex tissue of his senior labs. They were all built around the single unified idea of trying to build complex cell structures that would sequester ferrous products. It wasn't a holy grail, but it was a good, solid puzzle with a lot of applications for the terraforming efforts if it worked out. With the day out of lab, he had a double handful of data to look over and incorporate. And so did everyone else.
Hey, Big Dave!
Stepan was one of the other four students under Mr. Oki. He stood in the doorway, leaning on a crutch and smiling uncomfortably. He was pale as bleached flour and allergic to the pharmaceutical cocktail that kept bones dense and muscles functioning in the low Martian gravity. He's broken his leg twice since the year began.
Hey,
David said.
Pretty crazy about that tube blowout, eh?
Bizarre, David said.
So look, I was wondering,
You need something, David said.
Yeah.
David tapped his wide fingers across the display screen, letting the data batch process without him. Stepan limped into the room. With both of them there, the lab seemed too small.
I've got an anomaly on one of my runs. I mean, way off. 3 standard deviations.
You're fucked, cousin.
I know. I think I may have gotten some bad reagent.
Bad? Or wrong?
Wrong would be bad. Anyway, I know you've got some extras, and I was wondering...
Extras? A little knot squeezed in David's chest. Stepan shrugged and looked away like he'd said something he hadn't wanted to.
Sure, it's no big deal, right? But my chromium stuff has a lot of the same reagents. If I can scrounge enough together to do another run, I could discard the bad data.
I don't have that much stuff.
Stepan nodded, his head bowed down, eyes to the floor. He licked his lips, and David could see the desperation in the way he held his shoulders. David had imagined a million times what it would be like if his labs went pear-shaped, especially right before placements. It was everyone's nightmare.
Sure you do, Stepan said.
You're always getting equipment and supplies out of that other locker, right? I mean, you know.
I don't know,
David said. His mouth tasted like copper.
Sure you do,
Stepan said, not looking up. The tension in the room was vicious. Stepan hung his head like a whipped dog, but he wouldn't back away. The walls were too close, the air too stale. Stepan was breathing all the oxygen. The boy's gaze flickered up to meet David's and then away again. How much did Stepan know? How much did he suspect? Who else knew?
I'll help you,
David said, speaking like the words would cut his tongue if he spoke too fast.
You let me know what you need for another run, and I'll help you get it, okay? You can have a fresh run. We'll make the data set work.
Sure, thanks,
Stepan said. The relief in his shoulders wasn't faked.
Thank you.
Does Mr. Ogi know about the other locker?
No,
Stepan said with a grin that was almost camaraderie.
And never will, right?
So instead of working his data sets, David spent the morning going through the labs, looking for anyone he knew well enough to talk to. There were fewer than he'd hoped for, and the tension in the air made people short-tempered. Everyone was behind. Everyone had their own problems. Everyone was worried about their labs and their placements and whatever issues their families put on them. By afternoon, he'd given up. The only option left was to get on the network and order a fresh supply for Stepan from the distributor. It didn't take out too much from his secret account, and he wasn't the only one scrambling at the last minute to supply a lab. It was usually students buying their own things, he thought, but it wouldn't seem that odd to have someone doing a favor for a friend. As long as no one asked where the money came from, he'd be fine. When he got back to his actual labs, he felt like he'd already done a full day's work, and he'd hardly started. The hours passed quickly. By dinner time, he'd cleared and processed all the data from the day the tubes went down and started on the data for the day after. Just in time for the data that had been accruing while he'd been wandering around the labs to start showing up in the queue. With each batch file that appeared, David felt the night stretching out ahead of him. Maybe he just wouldn't sleep. If he could get through tomorrow, he'd have the whole backlog cleared. Unless someone blew something up, or Stepan decided he wanted something else to keep quiet. Or Aunt Bobby decided to come lift weights at him or something. David tried to stretch the headache out of the base of his skull and got back to work. At 7 minutes past dinner time, his hand terminal chimed. He accepted the connection with his thumb.
You aren't coming home for dinner?
his mother asked. Her voice was tinny and small, like air pressed into a straw.
No, David replied. I've got to finish my data sets. I thought they gave you the daytime to do that, she said.
On the hand terminal screen, she looked different than in person. Not older or younger, but both. It was like being shrunk down, rubbed out all the wrinkles around her eyes and mouth, but at the same time it made all the gray show in her hair.
I had some other stuff I needed to take care of.
The small screen version of her face went cool and distant. The tightness in David's shoulders started to feel like a weight.
Time management is an important skill, David,
she said, as if it were just a random thought. Not anything to do with him.
I know, he said. I'll put your meal up for when you get home. Don't be later than midnight.
I won't. The connection dropped, and David turned back to his data, growled, and slammed his fist into the display. The monitor didn't break. It didn't even error out. He might as well not have done anything. The next alert came in the middle of the evening when the labs were starting to empty. The voices in the hallways were fainter, almost lost in the drone and drum of music from the construction labs. The maintenance workers were coming through, old men and women with damp mops and desiccant powders. David almost ignored his hand terminal's tritone chime. It only started to bother him a little, wondering who would have sent a message rather than just opening a connection. He looked over. It was from Lily, and the header read, "Open when you're alone." David's concentration broke. His imagination leapt to the sorts of messages that girls sent to boys to be watched in private. He reached over and closed the door to his lab and hunched over the hand terminal. She was in a dark place, the light catching her from the side. In the background, a wry song was playing, all trumpets and ululating male voices. She licked her lips, her gaze flicked to the terminal's control display, and then back to him.
"David, I think I'm in trouble," she said.
Her voice shook, her breath pressing into the words.
"I need help, okay? I'm going to need help. And I know you like me, and I like you too. And I think you'll help me out, right? I need to borrow some money, maybe kind of a lot. I'll know soon, tomorrow maybe. Just send a message back if you can, and don't talk to Hutch."
A woman's voice called from the background, rising over the music, and Lily surged forward. The display went back to default, and David put in a connection request that timed out with an offer to leave a message instead. Grunting with frustration, he put in another request, then another. Lily's system was offline. He had the powerful urge to get to the tube station and go to Innis Shallows in person. But he didn't know where to find her once he was there. Didn't even know for sure she'd been there when she sent the message. Curiosity and dread spun up 100 scenarios. Lily had been caught with some product and had to bribe the police or she'd be jailed. One of Hutch's enemies had found her and was threatening to kill her if she didn't tell how to find him. So now she needed to get off-planet. Or she was pregnant, and she had to get to Donbod Nova for the abortion. He wondered how much money she'd need. He imagined the smile on her face when he gave it to her, when he saved her from whatever it was. But first he had to fix his data and get home. No one could know that something was happening. He set the hand terminal to record and placed himself in the center of the image.
"I'll do whatever I can, Lily. Just, you need to get in touch with me. Tell me what's going on, and I'll do whatever you need. Promise."
He felt like there was more. Something else he should add. He didn't know what.
Whatever it is, we'll get through it, right? Just call me.
He set the headers and delivered the message. For the rest of the evening, he waited for the chime of a connection request. It never came. When he got home, it was near midnight, but his father and Aunt Bobby were still awake. The living room monitor was set to a popular feed with a silver-haired, rugged-faced man talking animatedly. With the sound muted, he seemed to be trying to get their attention. David's father sat on the couch, the mass of his body commanding the space from armrest to armrest, like a king on his throne. Aunt Bobby leaned against the wall, lifting a 30-kilo weight with one arm as she spoke, then gently letting it descend.
"That's how I see it," she said.
"But it isn't like that," his father said. "You are a highly trained professional. How much did Mars invest in you over those years you were in the Corps? The resources that you took up didn't come from nowhere. Mars gave something up to give you those opportunities, those skill sets."
It was a tone of voice David had heard all his life, and it tightened his gut. The man on the monitor lifted his hands in outrage over something, then cracked what was meant to be a charming smile.
"And I appreciate that," Aunt Bobby said, her voice low and calm in a way that sounded more like shouting than his father's raised voice. "I've served, and those opportunities involved a lot of 18-hour days and—"
"No, no, no, no,"
his father said, massive hands waving in the air like he was trying to blow away smoke.
"You don't get to complain about the work. Engineering is just as demanding as—"
"And watching a lot of my friends die in front of me," Aunt Bobby finished.
The free weight rose and fell in the sudden silence. She shifted it to her other hand. His father's face was dark with blood, his hands grasping his knees. Aunt Bobby smiled. Her voice was sad.
"You're thinking about how you can top me on that, aren't you? Go ahead. Take your time."
David put his hand terminal down on the kitchen table, the click of plastic on plastic, enough to announce him. When they turned to look at him, David could see the family resemblance. For a moment, they were an older brother and a younger sister, locked in the same conversation they'd been having since they were children. David nodded to them and looked away, unsettled by the thought and vaguely embarrassed.
"Welcome home,"
his father said, rising up from the couch.
"How are things at the lab?"
"Fine," David said. "Mom said she'd put dinner up for me."
"There's some curry in the refrigerator."
David nodded. He didn't like curry, but he didn't dislike it. He put a double serving into a self-heating ceramic bowl and set it to warm. He kept his eyes down, wishing that they'd go on with whatever they'd been talking about so they'd forget about him, yet dreading listening to them fight if they did. Aunt Bobby cleared her throat.
"Did they find anything more about the tube thing?" she asked.
David could tell from the shift in her tone of voice that she'd put up the white flag. His father took a deep breath, letting it out slowly through his nose. David's curry tasted more of ginger than usual, and he wondered whether Aunt Bobby had made it.
"Newsfeed says they have leads,"
his father said at last.
"I imagine they'll get someone in custody by the end of the week."
"Are they saying outside involvement?"
"No. Some idiot protester trying to make a point about how vulnerable we are,"
his father said, as if he actually knew.
"It's happening everywhere. Selfish crap, if you ask me. We were on our way to making the schedule for the month before this happened. Now everyone's lost a day at least. That's not so much when it's just one person, but there were thousands of people thrown out off schedule. It's like Dad always says. 365 people miss one shift, that's a year gone in a day, you know?
Yeah, sort of, Aunt Bobby said. I remember it being 9,000 people miss an hour.
Same thought.
David's hand terminal chimed its tritone, and his heart raced. But when he pulled it closer, it was only the lower university's automated system posting the lab schedule for the next week. He looked through it without really taking it in. No surprises. He'd get his work done somehow. He killed the sound on his terminal and switched back to Lily's message just to see her face, the way her shoulders moved. She licked her lips again, looked down, and then up. He heard her voice in his memory. Not the message she'd sent him tonight, but the last thing she said the night the tube broke down. Just thought you'd come play, and I was wrong. Oh, God. Had she been thinking about having sex with him? Wouldn't Hutch have been angry? Or was that why Hutch had sent them away together? Was that what this was all about? Humiliation and a barely controlled erotic thrill mixed in his blood and left the curry seeming bland. He had to find Lily. Tomorrow, if he hadn't heard from her, he'd go to Innis Shallows. He could just ask around. Someone would know her. Maybe he could put off his data checking for one day. Or make Stepan do it. Guy owed him one, after all.
Well, kid,
his father said, stepping into the room. David flipped his hand terminal face down.
It's late and I've got work tomorrow.
Me too, David said.
Don't stay up too late.
Fine. His father's hand gripped his shoulder briefly, the pressure there and gone again. David ate the last few bites of curry and washed it down with a cup of cold water. In the living room, Aunt Bobby changed feeds on the monitor. A small, old, dark-skinned woman in an orange sari appeared on the screen, leaning forward and listening to an interviewer's question with an expression of polite contempt. Aunt Bobby coughed out a single, sour laugh and turned off the screen. She walked up to the kitchen, massaging her left bicep with her right hand and grimacing. She wasn't really any bigger than his father, but she was much stronger, and it made her carry herself like she was. David tried to remember if she'd killed anyone. He was pretty sure he'd heard a story about her killing someone, but he hadn't been paying attention. She looked down, maybe at his hand terminal turned with its face to the table. Her smile looked almost wistful, which was weird. She leaned against the sink and began pulling her fingers backward, pushing out her palm, stretching out the tendons and muscles of her wrist.
You ever go free climbing? She asked.
David glanced up at her and shrugged.
When I was about your age, I used to go all the time, she said. Get a breather and a couple of friends, head up to the surface or down. I went to Big Man's Cave a couple times right before my placement. No safety equipment. Usually just enough bottled air to go, do the thing, and get back to the closest ingress. The whole point was to try and carry as little as we possibly could. The thinnest suits, no ropes or pitons. There was one time I was on this cliff face about half a kilometer up from the ground, with my fist wedged into a crack to keep me in place while a windstorm came through. All I could hear was the grit hitting my helmet and my climbing buddies screaming at me to get out of there.
Scary, David said flatly. She didn't notice the sarcasm, or she chose not to.
It was great. One of the best climbs ever.
Your grandfather didn't like it, though.
That was the only time he's ever called me stupid.
David filled another glass of water and drank it. He had a hard time imagining it. Pop-Pop was always praising everyone for everything, to the point sometimes that it seemed like none of it really meant anything. He couldn't imagine his grandfather getting that angry.
his father sometimes called Pop-Pop the Sergeant Major when he was angry with him. It was almost like he was talking about another person, someone David had never met.
There was context, Aunt Bobby said. A guy I knew died in a fall about a month before. Troy.
What happened?
Now it was her turn to shrug. He was way up on a cliff and he lost his grip. The fall cracked his air bottle, and by the time anyone could get to him, he'd choked out. I wasn't there. We weren't friends. But to Dad, everyone who free climbed was the same, and anything that had happened to Troy could happen to me. He was right about that. He just, you know, thought I didn't know it.
Only you did.
Of course I did. That was the point, she said. She pointed to the hand terminal with her chin. If you flip it like that when he comes over, it makes him curious.
David tasted the copper of fear and pushed back from the table a few centimeters.
It wasn't anything. It was the lab schedule.
All right.
But when you flip it over, it makes him curious.
There's nothing to be curious about, David said, his voice getting louder.
All right, she said, and her voice was gentle and strong, and David didn't want to talk about it or look at her. Aunt Bobby walked back toward the guest room and bed. When he heard her shower go on, he picked up his hand terminal again and checked in case something had come through from Lily. Nothing had. He put what was left of his dinner into the recycler and headed for his room. As soon as he hit the mattress, his mind started racing. All of the things Lily might need money for started spinning through his mind. Drugs, or an attorney, or a passage off Mars. As soon as he thought that she might be leaving, he was sure that she was, and it left his chest feeling hollow and hopeless. And she'd told him not to talk to Hutch. Maybe she'd done something to piss him off, and now she had to get away before he caught her. He drifted to sleep, imagining himself standing between Hutch and Lily, facing him down to protect her. He'd run the scenario from the start. He walked in on the two of them fighting, and he pushed Hutch away. Or was with Lily, and Hutch came after her. He tried out lines.
Hurt her, and I'll make your life hell. Or, you think you've got all the power, but I'm David fucking Draper, cousin.
And imagined their effects. Lily's gratitude shifted into kissing, and from there, to her taking his hand and slipping it under her shirt. He could almost feel her body pressed against him. Could almost smell her. The dream shifted, and it was all about getting the datasets finished. Only Lily needed the money to change the results of her pregnancy test, and the bank was in a tiny crevasse in the back of his living room, and his hands were too thick to reach it. When his alarm went off, he thought it had broken. His body still had the too heavy, weak feeling of the middle of the night. But no, it was morning time. He pulled himself to the edge of his bed, let his feet swing down to the floor, and pressed his palms against his eyes. Even through the air filters, he caught the usually welcome scents of breakfast sausage and coffee. Una Meng looked out from his wall, eyes promising him something deep and mysterious. A diffuse resentment flowed through him, and he switched the image away from her to a generic preset of sunrise at Olympus Mons. Touristy. He had to make a plan. Maybe he could talk to Hutch after all. Not say Lily had talked to him, just that he was worried about her. That he wanted to find her. Because that was true. He had to find Lily, wherever she was, and make sure that she was all right. Then he had to finish his datasets. It was almost 2 hours to Innis Shallows and back, but if he just planned to work through lunchtime, or else eat in the labs, he'd only be losing 1 hour for travel.
he had to think about how to find her once he was there. He wished there was someone to talk to, even Hutch. There wasn't, though, and so he was going to have to solve this on his own. Go out, ask, look. She was counting on him. For a moment, he could feel her head resting against him, smell the subtle musk of her hair. So, yes, he'd go do this. No problem. Only one tube ran to Innis Shallows, back and forth along the same stretch. Since the sabotage of the tube system, there was more security present, men and women with pistols and gas grenades scowling and walking through the cars. The tube station at Innis Shallows didn't even have the usual perfunctory signs announcing that the end destination was Adderpole, like there were only two kinds of places in the universe, Innis Shallows and anywhere else. The official stats said that 6,000 people lived and worked in the Shallows, but walking out of the tube station, David still felt overwhelmed. The main halls were old stone behind clear sealant. White scars marked the places where decades of minor accidents had dug into it. Men and women walked or rode electric carts, moving up ramps from level to level. Most ignored him, but a few made a point of staring. He knew he didn't belong there. His clothes and the way he walked marked him. He stood for almost a minute in the center of the corridor, his hand in his pocket, fingers wrapped around his hand terminal. Behind him, the soft chimes of the tube preparing to leave again were like a friend's voice. Get on. Get out of here. This is dumb. He would have, too, turned back around and gotten on the tube and headed back without spending more than 5 minutes in the neighborhood. Except for Lily. David scowled, shook his head, and trudged down the corridor, heading off to his left for no reason. His throat felt tight and uncomfortable, and he needed to pee. After about 20 meters of cart rental kiosks and monitors set to entertainment news feeds, he found a little restaurant and stepped in. The woman behind the counter could have been a belter, thin body, too large head. She lifted her chin at him and nodded back toward half a dozen chipped-formed plastic tables.
Anywhere you want,
she said in a thick accent David couldn't place. David didn't move, looking for the courage to speak for so long, the woman raised her eyebrows. He yanked his hand terminal out of his pocket and held it out to her. He'd gotten a still from the message Lily had left him. It wasn't great, but the shape of her face was clear and she wasn't in the middle of a word or anything. I'm looking for her, David said. He sounded terse in his own ears, almost resentful. You know her? Her eyes flickered down and she shrugged.
Don't know her. You want to stay, you got to eat. Anywhere you want.
Her name's Lily. She hoisted her eyebrows. David felt a blush rising in his cheeks. Do you know where I could look for her?
Not here?
The woman suggested. David shoved the terminal back into his pocket and walked out. It was a stupid plan. Walk around the tube station, asking people at random? It was dumb, and it was humiliating. But it was Lily, so he did it. The hour was blank stares and shrugs and the growing sense that everyone he talked to was embarrassed for him. When the tube car returned, he'd found nothing. He sat alone on a formed plastic bench. The monitor shifted to a video review by a pretty girl whose voice made it sound like she was shouting every word.
Deka Adelaide's best story ever!
David looked up and down the sparsely populated car and came to the conclusion that he was the one who'd triggered the review. It said something about who the ad systems thought he was, what he cared about, like they knew. He pulled up his hand terminal,
made another connection request, and Lily didn't answer. He pulled up her message, playing it low.
I need help, okay?
And,
don't talk to Hutch.
Only there wasn't anyone else to talk to. He spent the afternoon catching up on his datasets, horrified to realize how far behind he'd let himself fall. He ran through number and correlations, checking the data against expected norms with the practice and contempt of long experience. He needed to put in extra time, get everything taken care of. If he fell too far behind, Mr. Oki would start noticing, and if there was a full audit, the extra lab work he'd done for Hutch would come out, and then he'd be screwed. He weighed calling in a favor from Stepan, but his mind kept shifting back to Lily and the closed faces of Innes Shallows. Someone had to know where she was, who she was. He had to work. For the first hour, reviewing and processing the data felt like hard labor, but then slowly, his mind fell into the rhythm. He managed the statistical input and brought out the correlations, fitting each one into the larger spreadsheet waiting for meta-analysis, and he could feel himself relax a little. The different catalytic mixes felt more like home than home did, and here, like nowhere else in his life, he was in control. Between the comfort and concentration of the work and his exhaustion, he fell into something like a trance. Time passed without any sense of duration. When he came to the end of the run, he could have been going for minutes or hours. Either one seemed plausible. He didn't think to check his hand terminal until he was almost home. There were 4 new messages waiting, none of them from Lily. The first was a correction to the lab schedule, then 2 posts from a gaming forum he subscribed to, even though he barely played any of the games. The last one was from the Central Educational Authority in Salton, the upper university. He flicked it open, and his head went as light as a balloon. He walked into the common room. His mother and father sat before the living room monitor, just far enough away from each other that their legs didn't touch. On the screen, an older man was leaning forward earnestly.
The Martian Project is the single most ambitious endeavor in human history. It is all of our duties to see that the threat of Earth...
What's the matter?
His father said. David lifted his hand terminal as if that was explanation enough. And then, when they didn't understand, he spoke. His voice had a distance to it. My placement came, he said. I'm going to development. His father whooped, stood so violently that the couch almost tipped over, as his dad's arms wrapped around him, lifting him up toward the ceiling, and his mother wept joyful tears into her hands. All David could think was, I'm supposed to be happy about this. After that, everything changed, and nothing did. He'd been working toward his placement for the last 5 sections, or looked at another way, his whole life. He'd known it was coming, everyone had, and still it felt like it had snuck up on him, surprised him. All of the things that had to happen after, the things he hadn't bothered thinking about because they were for later, had to be done now. There was the application for living space in the dormitories of the upper university, the coordination of his long-run experiments with Mr. Oki so that some new second year could step in and see them to completion, and the preparations and purchases that would, in the coming months, lead to David moving out of his room, out of his home, away from his family for the first time in his life. The times when the idea wouldn't scare him, it couldn't come fast enough. He could see it in his parents, too, the way his mother kept quietly weeping and grinning at the same time, the way his father made a point of sitting with him while he filled out his paperwork and put in for time off so he could go with David to the orientation in Salton next month, and brought him sandwiches and coffee for lunch. David had done everything he was supposed to do, had gotten the grades and the attention and the status for the highest placement he'd qualified for, and the reward was even less freedom. It was like his parents had suddenly realized he wouldn't be there forever, and now their love was like a police state. He couldn't escape it. He couldn't go look for Lily or even send out connection requests. The only one who didn't seem to react one way or the other was Aunt Bobby, who just kept her weird, vaguely intrusive habits of watching the news feeds and lifting weights. 3 days after the letter came, David was set to go to the Lower University for his first transition meeting with Mr. Oki. His father went with him. Dad held his head high, chin up, beaming like he'd been the one to do something. They walked up the stairs to the Lower University Commons together, David shrinking into his own chest with the discomfort. This was his world, his friends and enemies, the people who knew him for himself. And Dad didn't belong there. Stepan nodded to him but didn't approach. The girl who'd borrowed his stats array last year frowned at his dad, strutting at David's side. They knew that his being there was wrong, and they drew back, keeping the separation. They all had two lives, too, and they weren't supposed to mix like this. Everybody knew that.
Mr. Oki,
his father said as they rounded one of the seating areas. The research advisor smiled politely, walking toward them.
Mr. Draper, Mr. Oki said. It's good of you to come.
Just want to make sure everything's smooth,
Dad said, caressing the air as he said it.
Development's a good placement, but it's a hard one. David doesn't need any distractions.
Of course not, Mr. Oki agreed.
Over the old man's shoulder, David caught sight of Hutch. He was standing with a couple of the second years, smiling and listening to a girl whose hands were fluttering and tapping at the air as she explained something. Lily wasn't with him. David felt his heart rate spike. It was an epinephrine dump. His mind jumped back a section to his physiology labs. Epinephrine was binding to alpha-adrenergic sites, dropping insulin production, upping glycogenolysis and lipolysis. Standard fight or flight. Hutch glanced over, nodded politely. David pointed toward the men's room with his chin. Hutch's expression slipped a notch darker, and he shook his head, not more than a few millimeters, and unmistakable. David scowled and nodded toward the men's room again.
Are you all right?
His dad asked.
I have to pee, David said. I'll be right back.
He left his father and Mr. Oki bantering. The white tile and video mirrors of the men's room were like a retreat to his world, and escape. He stood at the urinal, pretending to piss until the one other student washed his hands and left. Hutch walked in.
What's the word, friend?
Hutch said. But David could hear annoyance in the syllables.
Saw you got family with today. Good to see a father so concerned with his son's business.
David zipped his fly and trundled over to Hutch. He kept his voice low.
He's just being an asshole. It's nothing. We've got to meet, David said. We have to talk. Not now, but we've got to.
Slow, slow, slow,
Hutch said.
Now's not a good time. Tomorrow night, David said. The usual place.
Can't do that. Other plans.
Tonight, then, David hissed.
David's hand terminal chimed, and a moment later, Hutch's did too. The local news feed pushing a breaking story. David didn't look away.
Hutch's expression shifted from annoyance into anger, and then a wary kind of amusement. He shrugged.
"See you tonight, then, little man,"
Hutch said. His lopsided smile looked dangerous. David nodded and trotted back out to the commons. He wouldn't tell Hutch about the message or about Lily being in trouble. He'd just say he wanted to find her. He'd say it was about his placement, because that made it seem like there was something else. Distracting. He got back to Mr. Oki and his father, gathering himself back together, willing himself to act normal, before he noticed that the commons was silent. Everyone was hunched over their hand terminals, their faces gray or flushed. Even his father and Mr. Oki. The newsfeed push had a picture of a public corridor, the air hazed by smoke. A policeman hunched over something, one hand on his hip. The header read, "Explosion in Salton."
"What happened?"
he asked.
"Protesters,"
his father said, and the anger in his voice was startling.
"Anti-Earth protesters."
David's hand terminal chimed again. The header shifted. "Explosion in Salton. 3 confirmed dead."